Adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu.
An important anniversary is being celebrated this month, namely the anniversary of the birth of Robert E. Lee, a great American, an important American, and of course also an American who stood right at the fulcrum of a very crucial moment in American history. A number of admirably, thoroughly written books have been crafted about Robert E. Lee. One of the most intriguing and impressive is a book called The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. In this book, the author, Jonathan Horn, draws very interesting and intriguing connections between Robert E. Lee and the father of our country, George Washington. Connections both figurative and literal to an extent. And then also traces some intriguing parallels between where Washington was and the role that he played in America's Revolution and the role which Robert E. Lee played on behalf of the Confederacy in the war between the states. The book is beautifully written and absolutely fascinating. And the author, Jonathan Horn, is actually a former White House presidential speechwriter. And you have perhaps seen his commentary on MSNBC, his writing in the New York Times, and in other places as well. And this new book, published by Simon & Schuster, again is called The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. Jonathan Horn, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do I remember that you were a speechwriter under the second President Bush?
That's exactly right, and that's a great way to learn history. Whether you work in a Republican administration or a Democratic administration, you have a chance to see how leaders make decisions firsthand. And so much of my book was about a decision that Robert E. Lee had to make. So it really was great preparation before I started writing this.
I'm sure about that. I wanted to just mention parenthetically, and I promise we won't spend a lot of time on this, but you're the second speechwriter of for President Bush that I've had the privilege of speaking to on the morning show. I also interviewed David Frum upon the a publication of a book which he wrote about his experiences as a speechwriter for President Bush. I wonder. I think you've already touched on an important matter that when one is sort of in the inner circle, you have a perspective that most of the rest of us do not have. That is of the importance, the momentousness of so many decisions and of how those decisions are made, and then of how those decisions are explained to the rest of the world. And I should think it is an incredible opportunity to be on the inside as those kind of events unfold.
You put it very well, and so much of what speech writing is explaining decisions that presidents make. Your job in some ways is to write the speech that the president would write if he had time to put down all of his ideas on paper. And so you're very much trying to capture what his vision is and to explain to the American people why he made a decision. And these decisions often have very large consequences. So it really is terrific training. And of course, so much of the way we explain decisions that presidents make is going back and looking at what our country has done before, because that's one of the most effective arguments a president has, is to say this idea worked in the past. A president who we all admire did something similar. And so it's very crucial for White House speechwriters to have a good handle on American history.
I remember one other thing Mr. Frum happened to say in our interview was that there is something especially challenging about writing words that a U.S. president will utter, because in a sense it's like handing a tennis ball to somebody who has the world's most powerful racket. Because, I mean, I could say those same words and they wouldn't mean anything, but those words spoken by the President of the United States, arguably the most powerful political leader in the world, those words can have incredible consequences, ramifications far beyond what might have been originally intended. I should think that that makes the work also, in a sense, kind of fraught with some tension, because you have to be so very, very careful to be true to the man for whom you're working, and careful that the words that he says will be clear and not misunderstood and not set certain events into motion unintentionally.
I think that's a great point. And so much of what speechwriting is keeping in mind that this isn't your speech. Because no, when you're a speechwriter, you're not paid to express your own views. Your whole job, the whole service you're providing, is to express the views of the president. And there is a great responsibility that comes with that. And clarity of message is so important. You have to make sure that the sentences say exactly what they're supposed to say and what the president's vision is. And so I think clarity and having a sense of what the president's values are so important. And so much, by the way, sometimes when we talk about presidential speeches, we blame them on speechwriters, and that's always a mistake, because truly the speech is the president, and only great presidents can give great speeches.
I wonder, too, and this is to help guide us into a conversation about your fascinating book, what was your background that led you ultimately to that position to be a speechwriter within the walls of the White House? I mean, growing up, for instance, were you a political science major or history major, or what was the path that ultimately took you to Washington?
Well, I was actually born not too far from Washington, so I was always watching politics and learning about history. I actually grew up in the suburbs of Washington, and so when you grow up there, you're immersed in history from a very early age. But I myself was an English major in college, so my background is very much as a writer, and I've always, as I said, I've always had been passionate about history. And those two things, if you like writing, you like history, speech writing is a great place to start your career. And so I had actually been writing for a cabinet secretary when I got the opportunity to move over to the White House.
So, as a matter of fact, I recall that from the acknowledgments, I think you said the inspiration for this book flowed out of years spent near the river that Robert E. Lee and George Washington called home. Tell us about that river. I assume you mean the Potomac.
Right, so that is the Potomac River, and some people that seems strange, because we imagine Robert E. Lee, we don't think of necessarily the city of Washington. But Robert E. Lee was very much a product of the Potomac. He was born on a plantation called Stratford Hall, downriver from Washington. He grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, but what then was actually Alexandria in the District of Columbia. And, of course, he fought some of his most famous battles along the Potomac. And, of course, George Washington has many connections to the Potomac, starting with Mount Vernon, which is right on the Potomac. And Alexandria, during Robert E. Lee's childhood, very much considered itself to be George Washington's hometown, even though Washington was no longer alive. And then, of course, the most obvious connection to Washington on the Potomac is the city of Washington. So there are just so many connections between these two men, and anybody who travels along the Potomac confronts this question of, what is the relationship between these two men, and what made Robert E. Lee, who was so connected to George Washington, go to war against Washington's Union?
Now that this book has taken shape, it makes perfect sense. But was there any particular moment and some sort of tangible catalyst that set all of this in motion for you, that made you realize that this was something that had not yet been adequately explored before and was worthy of this kind of time and attention?
It was as I started exploring the connections between Robert E. Lee and George Washington that I became to realize there really was this tragic tension, that this army officer who was so closely associated with George Washington, and I think most people don't realize how close those associations were. Robert E. Lee's father was a man named Light Horse Harry Lee, who was actually George Washington's most famous eulogist, the man who wrote the words, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, which of course are still the words that we associate with George Washington today. And then Robert E. Lee had actually married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son, and these connections were seen as so influential on the eve of the Civil War that leaders on both sides of the conflict saw tremendous significance in trying to acquire Lee's services for their side. An emissary for Abraham Lincoln actually called Robert E. Lee to the city of Washington and said that the country looks to you to save the Union as the representative of the Washington family. So you just have this amazing tension. And then the decision that Lee makes destroys his bonds to Washington in these astonishingly personal ways.
Hmm. And in other words, both sides, North and South, were hoping that Robert E. Lee would enter this war on their particular side. And, of course, the decision that he ultimately makes is to go with the Confederacy, or maybe more accurately, to go with Virginia. It seems like that's where his most fervent loyalties lay. Not so much that he was a great champion of the South seceding from the Union, but his beloved Virginia was so close to his heart.
You're exactly right, and I'm glad you made that distinction, because actually when you look at Robert E. Lee's letters that he's writing on the eve of the Civil War, he is personally opposed to secession, and he's actually reading a George Washington biography, and he thinks that Washington himself would have been opposed to secession. He mourns the wreckage of Washington's labors, but he can't make this decision to go to war against his native state of Virginia. As much as he loves the Union, he feels that his first loyalty is due to the state of Virginia. So he gets this offer to command the main Union army in Washington, and he turns it down immediately. And then his mentor in the military, a man named Winfield Scott, who is also a Virginian, is going to make the opposite decision from Lee and stay with the Union, tells Lee and says, "Lee, you have made the greatest mistake of your life, but I feared it would be so."
Hmm. And it's so important for us to think about the decision that confronted, the choice that confronted Robert E. Lee and Winfield Scott and countless other men at this moment in our history, because there were all kinds of people, not just people as famous as Robert E. Lee, who in a sense lived on the divide or for whatever reason found their loyalties divided between the two sides and had to make what I'm sure were in many cases incredibly painful and perhaps frightening choices.
You're absolutely right again. And Robert E. Lee's own sister is going to be on the Union side, for example. So this does divide families in ways that it's difficult, I think, for us to imagine today, because the Civil War has settled this in some sense, and we know we are first and foremost Americans. But this is an incredibly agonizing period.
We're speaking with Jonathan Horn, and we're talking about his book, The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War, and his decision that changed American history. Before we delve into some specifics about this remarkable story, I wonder if you could just say a word about the way you went about researching your book and what kind of sources were particularly valuable to you in crafting this new study of Robert E. Lee.
Right. So, of course, one thing I did was I went to the places where history happened, and that means looking at the battlefields and going to these historic sites associated with Lee. But you can't really understand those things and what they meant to Robert E. Lee unless you go to the archives and you look at the letters that he wrote to his family members and to his wife and to his children. So the good, great part about Lee is we don't totally have to guess. We don't have to guess what he was thinking, because he was writing these beautiful letters throughout his entire life. And he really gives a sense of who he is and what he thinks. And so you get a sense of who he is. And his letters, fortunately, are scattered, or not fortunately, but they're scattered in different archives. But most of those archives aren't too far away from where I live around Washington. So I traveled around and I spent a lot of time hunched over in dark archives. And being able to have an 150-year-old letter in front of you and spend time with it is just a great privilege and opportunity to have this great insight into history.
Hmm. What about turning farther back to the time of George Washington, which, of course, is a little bit more of a challenge in terms of what survives and of course, also the myth that has sprung up around such a figure. What was most valuable for you in sharpening our our view and understanding of George Washington himself, who in a sense is the other figure who is so prominent in your book.
Right, and so we're fortunate that so many of Washington's papers have been collected and published. So in some sense, it's easier to have a sense of Washington because his papers have been put together in just great collections that put them at our fingertips. Any Washington letter is searchable. At the same time, of course, we don't have as many Washington letters to his wife, for example, because she burned their correspondence. So that is a tremendous loss for history. And I was fortunate also to be able to look at what other historians, the research they had done into Washington, and learn a lot about him that way.
One of the specific books you mention in your book, is the first full-length biography of Washington that was written not very long after his death. And do I remember the last name of the author is something like Weems or Wemyss, something like that?
That Weems, exactly. That's exactly right. And that book, it had a huge circulation. He wanted to get a biography out of Washington as soon as possible, and that's where some of our most famous stories about Washington come from. For example, the story of him with the cherry tree, which, of course, there's no reason to believe is true. But these stories took on a great meaning in Robert E. Lee's youth. And actually, Robert E. Lee's father, who I mentioned was George Washington's most famous eulogist, had a quote on the title page endorsing the book.
Hmm.
You can only imagine what impact that would have on people reading it and connecting the Lee name and the Washington name together. And during Robert E. Lee's childhood and all the way up to the Civil War, it's difficult for us to imagine today, but there's this cult of Washington. Everybody in America, in some sense, looks up to Washington, and his character is the model that you raise your children to be like.
Hmm. So you tell us that almost certainly Robert E. Lee himself, as a young man, as a boy, read this Washington biography by Mr. Weems. And you write, for decades, the Washington whom Weems created became the Washington whom Americans revered. By studying this Washington's virtues, every youth, Weems promised, may become a Washington. One Abraham Lincoln remembered devouring the book while growing up in the backwoods of Indiana in the earliest days of my being able to read. So this is the kind of figure whom George Washington was. We don't always fully appreciate that.
That's right, and we can't say exactly what Lee himself read, though almost everybody did read this book. But we do know it was extremely influential in the life of Abraham Lincoln. He talked about it later. And Lincoln, of course, was born without any connection to George Washington. One of the things we can get into later is today, I think, when you say the name George Washington, the next name that comes to mind is Abraham Lincoln. And so they do have this amazing connection. In some sense, Lincoln made the promise in that book, every youth may become a Washington. He made it true.
Hmm. Well, the tangible connection between Robert E. Lee and George Washington is, of course, as we've already talked about, the very strong connection between George Washington and Robert E. Lee's father, Harry Lee. And one of the things you tell us about Washington is that maybe in part because he never had any children of his own, he and his wife, Martha, never had any children of their own, and so this might have been one reason why George Washington took such a strong interest in some of the younger soldiers, younger officers in his army, and forged some of his strongest personal connections with them, and Lee would have been one of them.
That's right, and so Lee was actually offered a spot in George Washington's military family, which would have been his personal staff, and that included men like Alexander Hamilton, who really did have extremely close bonds to George Washington. But Light Horse Harry Lee did not accept this offer because he was so committed that he wanted to stay in the field and continue in a combat role. But they did have an extraordinarily close relationship, and actually Light Horse Harry Lee had some real insights into George Washington's personality. And in some sense, he realized that Washington had a lot of passions, actually, because we think of Washington with so much, in some way, in so much control of himself. And what the amazing part was that he was able to control himself and exert control over his temper. And Light Horse Harry Lee became a tragic figure because he could never find that same self-control in his own life. And actually, he would end up losing almost his entire fortune in bad land speculation. And he would end up in the Caribbean in exile away from Robert E. Lee when Robert E. Lee was growing up.
Hmm. By the way, we probably haven't really said it sufficiently, but we should maybe more clearly describe the Lee family at the time of the American Revolution. You call them one of Virginia's finest families, and of course their connection with this era of our country's history is a really powerful one, in ways even beyond Harry Lee's presence at the side of George Washington. Tell us a little more about the Lee family in this generation.
Right. So the Lee family had really established itself by this time as one of Virginia's great families. And actually, two Lee brothers, would sign the Declaration of Independence. So that gives you an idea just how prominent the family is. And one of the things that actually haunts Light Horse Harry Lee during the Revolutionary War is this feeling that maybe he's benefiting from nepotism.
Intriguing. The importance of this family, of course, is also tainted, of course, by what you've already touched on, the fact that Harry Lee ends up leaving the military, in a sense, maybe prematurely, at the age of 26. You say he fixed on a new course that would lead to insolvency and further personal and professional ruin. In some ways, it's hard to imagine how a family could recover from that kind of disgrace. Can you explain that?
Right, and so that's something that Robert E. Lee grew up with. In some sense, his family didn't have a lot of means. As I said, Robert E. Lee was born on a plantation called Stratford Hall downriver from Washington, but he didn't grow up there. He grew up in the town of Alexandria, and he grew up really without a father because his father had gone off to the Caribbean, and his mother really instilled in him the values of self-control and self-denial, these values that Harry Lee has lacked when he had shown that he had lost his fortune in land speculation, and they didn't want that tragedy to reoccur. And so I think you can say that's how Lee developed the sense of duty that would play a very important role later in his life.
You describe in really touching fashion, I think, his utter devotion to his mother. And at one point you write, in a sense, Robert gave up the indulgences of boyhood because his father turned down the responsibilities of manhood. So in what ways did young Robert E. Lee do this?
Right. So his mother was actually quite sickly. And all the descriptions we have, or many of the descriptions we have of Lee's childhood, they're always describing him as something other than a boy. They're describing him as a nurse, taking care of his mother and taking her on carriage rides. They describe him as a housekeeper who is doing the marketing for the family. They describe him, Lee's mother even almost says that she's a daughter to her because he is playing such a role in terms of caring and tending to her needs. And so this really is a boy who spends whose main thing we know about his childhood is this sense of duty that he owes. And he would actually, Tim, later say, though, that he owed everything to his mother because she had taught him so much in terms of giving him the values that made Lee who he is.
Hmm. You also mentioned that Robert E. Lee would describe himself, particularly as he grew into adulthood, but it sounds like it was a characteristic that was also part of his makeup as a young man, I mean, even as a child, that he was often full of despair. You write, he suffered bouts of sadness that left him wretched or miserable. He confessed that he was naturally inclined to melancholy. A sense of fatalism had seeped into his thoughts, a chemical bond he could not understand to a father whom he could barely remember. Only later in life, when watching his own son struggle with what he called my gravity, would Lee allude to its hereditary quality. So are we talking here about what might be in our own age be diagnosed as depression? And if that's the truth or that's the case, how in the world did Lee manage to go on to accomplish what he did, bearing that kind of emotional load?
Right, I, it's difficult to put an exact medical diagnosis on it. But
of course,
Lee certainly was inclined to melancholy, as he said, and he has this overwhelming sense of frustration. Now, he could also be very funny. He could be, especially as a young man, he was very flirtatious with women, and they made note of that. And he was an extremely good-looking man. He's just under 6 feet tall. He has a barrel chest. He has broad shoulders. He is extremely good-looking, and women note that he is very good-looking. But at the same time, underneath all of this, he is a very frustrated person, and he's frustrated throughout his entire life. He always has this sense that he can't have things his own way, and he must accept things another way. And this is something that goes on throughout his entire life, and even into the Civil War, when we imagine Robert E. Lee as leading campaigns and having great success by seizing the initiative in battle, he always still feels that things are not his own way, and he is just doing what he has no choice about.
Mm. The other connection with George Washington that we have not yet mentioned is the woman whom Robert E. Lee married, and her own father, his direct connection to the father of our country, in and of itself is a fascinating story.
Right, and this is actually Robert E. Lee's strongest connection to George Washington, which is that he married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son. And George Washington's adopted son was a man named George Washington Parke Custis. And he actually built Arlington House for anyone who's ever been to Washington. It's now a cemetery, but atop Arlington Cemetery, there's this columned mansion. And that was built by George Washington's adopted son. And at the time, it very much served as a museum of almost as a shrine to George Washington. It was filled with furniture and china and portraits that had once been at Mount Vernon. And people came from all across America to come see Arlington House. And that's where Robert E. Lee, on June 30th, 1831, married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son.
Hmm. It was, you tell us, his approval of the marriage did not come immediately or all that easily, but eventually gave his blessing to this particular union. Tell us a little bit about this marriage.
Right. So it got off to a rocky start in some ways, and George Washington Parke Custis did have some questions because the Lee family name had been tainted by scandal, and there was actually another scandal with Robert E. Lee's half-brother. And so there was reason for him to question whether this was a good match for his daughter. And then, of course, there was Robert E. Lee's military career, which made for a tough life for his wife, who was used to a more gentle life at Arlington. And Robert E. Lee actually worries about this himself, whether his wife will be able to adapt to the conditions of being a military spouse.
It is a fascinating experience which Robert E. Lee has as he goes to West Point and eventually fights in the Mexican War and, of course, ultimately into the Civil War that stretches beyond. As we read about that, we certainly are reminded that this is a turbulent period in our country's history in which so much of the country is wrestling with this issue of slavery. You especially explore this in the fourth chapter of your book titled Half Slave, Half Free. And just one way in which this plays out in more of a political arena is when you tell us about the decision of Alexandria, Virginia, to vote for something called retrocession, which I'd never heard this or seen this term before, nor heard about this decision, which was made way back in 1846. Just say a word about this, because I think it's a very good indication of what is brewing in the United States years before the Civil War ultimately breaks out.
So if you ever look at a map of the District of Columbia, and then you look at the area right below the Potomac in Virginia, Arlington and Alexandria, and you add that back to what we think of as the District of Columbia today, you'll notice that it forms a perfect square, a perfect diamond-shaped square. And that was actually the original District of Columbia as George Washington laid it out when he was president. He wanted Alexandria to be in the bottom corner of the District of Columbia, and actually would have put Arlington, of course, into the District of Columbia as well. But for a number of reasons, when we get into the 1840s, this arrangement is not so popular among Virginia, among people in Alexandria and Arlington, who no longer want to be under federal authority. Now, there are a number of reasons for why they decide to go back and leave the District of Columbia and join Virginia, but one of them is definitely a concern about whether Congress can exert power over the slave trade in Alexandria. And the slave trade was very important to Alexandria's economy.
Hmm. You also spell out on a more personal level how this whole matter of slaves, what to do with slaves, what freeing the slaves, which one might own yourself, how this played out in very complicated fashion for Robert E. Lee himself, with his own father-in-law's estate. Just say a quick word about this. We can read about it in greater detail in your book, but say a word about this complicated chapter in the family's life.
So Robert E. Lee, for the most part, tried to avoid interactions with slavery. He didn't like the institution. He actually thought the institution was evil. That said, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking he was an abolitionist. He simply just didn't want to be involved with it personally if he could avoid it. And he prayed for a day that God would actually end slavery, which sort of conveniently excused him from having to take any personal responsibility. But what most brings him into the institution is that when his father-in-law dies, who, as I mentioned, was George Washington's adopted son, he leaves a will that names Robert E. Lee as executor of estates that include a large number of slaves. And actually, a good number of these slaves have strong connections to Mount Vernon. And so on the eve of the Civil War, Robert E. Lee is managing estates that include slaves who have descended from George Washington's home.
So it's just touches on the complexity of this issue, and that in many families, this was sometimes a reality that was not extensively spoken of, or with which probably the current generation was very uncomfortable. I mean, I think more than anything, it just helps us realize that it is a mistake to make sweeping generalizations about what people were experiencing at this time in our country's history. It was a complicated world for just about everybody, no matter what side of this issue you happen to be on.
You're right. And one of the interesting things about the will that Robert E. Lee's father-in-law leaves is he says he wants the slaves to be emancipated within 5 years or when the debts and legacies of the estate have been paid. And these goals are somewhat contrary because Lee can't figure out how he's going to raise these sums without the slaves. And so he actually is into the position where he's trying to file court papers to extend the servitude of the slaves. You can file this entire legal battle that plays out and into the Civil War, actually. And as it turns out, in the end, the timing that Robert E. Lee actually ends up having to emancipate the slaves that belong to his father-in-law is the same timing for Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which is just one of those an unbelievable coincidence.
Hmm. Another thing you explore in your book is in a chapter called Washington's Sword, is a connection that maybe a lot of us might not have heard about, or if we learned about it once, have forgotten, namely Robert E. Lee's connection with John Brown. How are these two important figures connected, and what kind of difference do you think this encounter ultimately made in what would follow for Robert E. Lee in those next few years as the Civil War broke out and he had his own decision to make about his own allegiance?
Right. So in 1859, John Brown and a group of abolitionists crossed the Potomac River and seized the federal armory at Harper's Ferry. They actually also take a number of hostages, including a great-grandnephew of George Washington. And the Army officer who's called out to go to Harper's Ferry and put down this insurrection is Robert E. Lee. And so Robert E. Lee, we don't often think about him when we think about John Brown's raid, but he played a very important part in it. And when he goes there, he actually sort of dismisses the importance of John Brown. But, of course, John Brown is going to play a pivotal role in bringing on the Civil War. This raid really serves as a preview of what is to come.
Do you have a sense that incident specifically swayed Robert E. Lee in any way? Would that have been a significant contributor to the decision that Robert E. Lee ultimately makes to go with the South rather than the North?
I think it's hard to say. In terms of his own writing after the raid, Virginians and Northerners and people throughout the South and North are making a great big deal about John Brown and saying this is a momentous event in the history of our country. And Lee is actually dismissing its importance and saying it was just the work of a fanatic and the plot had no chance of success. So he very much tries to play down the role of John Brown. But at the same time, when he's looking at events as the country is coming apart, he is able to say that I understand the grievances that have been made, that the North has, that the abolitionists have been aggressive against the South. And that is somewhat of the attitude he has on the eve of the war. At the same time, though, he doesn't think it's an excuse to have the country fall apart. And he actually thinks having the country dissolve will make all the problems worse for the South.
As this Civil War looms, you pose an interesting question in the midst of the chapter called The Decision. What Washington himself would have done at the start of the Civil War remains a hypothetical question that historians cannot answer. Though a member of Washington's cabinet once heard the president say that in the event the Union split in half, he had made up his mind to remove and be of the Northern. And, of course, we're talking about someone who had very close ties to this very same region as Robert E. Lee. And it is, of course, intriguing to think about, but impossible to know for sure, just where George Washington's own allegiance would have been tied to the North or to the South or to Virginia. But it helps place in context then the turbulence that had to be going on in Robert E. Lee's own mind. How much did Robert E. Lee share about what he went through at this moment in his life? Or are we left mostly to surmise his thought process and the choice he ultimately made?
The great part about it is we don't have to exactly guess what was going on, because he was writing letters to his family members explaining his decision. And actually, I would go back to the point you made about George Washington and say that one of the most important things to keep in mind is we can't know what George Washington would have done, though we do know that George Washington's farewell address did say, put the Union above all sectional loyalties. You should be Americans first. And so a lot of people did wonder, how could Robert E. Lee, who was so associated with George Washington, not make that same choice? But what's so important is that people on both sides of the argument try to take George Washington and claim him for their own. You have secessionists who say, well, George Washington was a revolutionary, so he would have supported our cause. And on the other side, as I mentioned, you have unionists who say, no, George Washington, his great contribution to this country was the Union, and he had said, put the Union above everything else, so he would have supported the Union. Where did Robert E. Lee come down in this debate? Well, as I said, we don't have to guess, because he's writing it on the eve of the war. He says that he thinks George Washington would have opposed secession. He thinks that George Washington would have mourned the destruction of the labor, and he says he can't imagine the founding fathers would have built the country just to have it be so easily come apart. Lee later changes his views on this question somewhat after the Civil War, but this is very much what he feels on the eve of the Civil War.
So what is it exactly that he would have been doing had he said yes to President Lincoln and to the North? What exactly is the role that he was being offered at that moment.
So often we hear that he would have been the Union's ranking general, and that's not actually true. He was basically being offered the command of what would later become known as the Army of the Potomac, which, of course, is the main army in the Eastern theater of the war. And, of course, we know some of the other gentlemen who went through that role and really struggled to lead this army in the early days of the war.
It is really something, the way you describe this sort of succession of events. And I think it's especially admirable that you make it as sort of tense an affair as possible, even though as we're reading the book, we all know ultimately Robert E. Lee is obviously going to go with the Confederacy. But somehow you almost make us wonder as we turn the pages, just how is this going to ultimately unspool? You write at one point, only one word now separated Lee from the pinnacle of his profession, from command of what would be the largest American army ever assembled, from glory that no American since Washington had known. Blair, in Lee's telling, tried in every way to persuade him to say yes. Is it your sense that he came very close to saying yes?
I don't think he did come that close to saying yes. I think it must have been tempting, but at the same time, I think he always felt he could not participate in what would probably require an invasion of his native state of Virginia. He had always been very clear that his first loyalty was due to Virginia. Now, Francis Blair, who you mentioned, and who was the emissary for Abraham Lincoln making this offer, said that Lee hesitated, but Lee denied this. He said he gave his answer once and at once, and that he could never do this. And then he goes, of course, to his mentor in the military, Winfield Scott, and he tells him what he's done, and Scott says he's made the greatest mistake of his life. And shortly afterward, Robert E. Lee is going to resign his commission in the Union Army, and his wife calls that decision to resign from the Union Army the severest struggle of his life.
Hmm. It's interesting as we follow then the events of the war itself as it is waged, and the role, of course, that General Lee plays. And one of the things that you do that I think is also quite intriguing is not only do we follow the events of the war and General Lee himself, but in a sense you also trace Mount Vernon itself through these years. Tell us why you decided to do that.
Well, one reason why is during Robert E. Lee's very first campaign in the field. This is after he has accepted command of Virginia's armed forces, and then Virginia actually transfers its forces to the Confederacy and sort of leaves Robert E. Lee without a very clear role in the military. But he does get this assignment to go out to Western Virginia, and he brings with him some aides. And one of his personal aides is George Washington's great-grandnephew. And he is actually the heir to Mount Vernon, and he has actually just sold Mount Vernon to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which now still today is in charge of Mount Vernon. And so actually the heir to Mount Vernon is going to die under Robert E. Lee's command, and this is a death that has tremendous meaning to Lee. It embitters Lee, and it also has a tremendous meaning to the country because everybody has been aware of this sale of Mount Vernon and the symbolism of this figure.
Well, ultimately, of course, we follow the events to what ends up being, of course, a very, very difficult end of the war for all of Virginia and Virginians and for Robert E. Lee himself. Say a quick word, if you would, about the incredible stature which Robert E. Lee, even in the wake of defeat, enjoyed. Particularly in the eyes of his fellow Southerners.
Right. So Lee had very much become a symbol of the Confederacy, and which is somewhat ironic because, as I said, he was so reluctant to fight against the Union. But he does become this symbol. And then at Appomattox, he makes this choice to accept the outcome that he is defeated. Actually, one of his most brilliant artillery officers comes to Lee with a different proposal. He says, why don't you scatter your army and we can fight like rabbits in the bushes? And this is basically a proposal for guerrilla warfare. But Lee says, no, that would bring on a state of affairs that would take the country decades to recover from. There's only one responsible thing for me to do, and that's to go see General Grant and accept the outcome here. And so Lee then encourages everybody in the South to raise their children to be Americans because it's important to put this conflict behind them. And that's something that he has gotten a great deal of respect for in history.
You tell us, and I think a lot of times we, to some extent, we know this, and yet it's good that we are reminded of this. Lee had lost his family home. He had lost his wife's inheritance, the same fortune John Adams believed made George Washington first in war and first in peace. Despite all that Lee had done differently, despite all the discipline he had demonstrated from his childhood in Alexandria through his career ending in Appomattox, he had repeated his father's fate. He was not a Washington. He was a Lee. I mean, you paint that picture in very stark terms that in many respects, in the terms that with which the world typically measures success, Robert E. Lee at this point in time was a failure. And yet, of course, not in the eyes of so many who revered him and who would continue to revere him to his death.
And what's interesting about Lee is throughout his entire life, he has this sense of failure. It's not actually just this moment. It's throughout his entire life, he's frustrated and feels that he can't do what he wants to do. And it's just one of the main traits that makes Lee who he is. In terms of his family home, which I'm glad you mentioned, of course, one of the very first things that happens after Robert E. Lee makes the decision to resign his commission in the Union Army is that federal forces from the city of Washington, cross the Potomac River and go up the Arlington Heights and seize that high ground, because if you've ever been to Washington, you can imagine what Virginians could have done if they had fortified the Arlington Heights. They could have bombarded the White House. So they seize the house, they seize the Arlington Heights, and eventually, of course, they're going to turn Arlington into the cemetery that we know today.
It's an amazing story, and it's beautifully told and obviously meticulously researched, and includes some intriguing photographs and drawings as well, plus a family tree, which charts for us the Washington and Lee families and their connection with one another. The book, again, is called The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. The book is published by Scribner and the author, Jonathan Horn. Jonathan Horn, it was a great pleasure for me to speak with you about your fascinating book. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be previewing a fascinating documentary that airs tomorrow night on the PBS series American Experience. It chronicles the life and career of the extraordinary inventor Thomas Alva Edison. I'll be speaking to the writer, producer, director of the documentary, Michelle Ferrari, on tomorrow's Morning Show. On Wednesday, I reconnect with Patrick Moran. That will be a familiar name to many Kenosians. He is a former mayor of Kenosha, and he's written a very interesting memoir about his early life titled A Story of a Baby Boomer. You'll hear my conversation with Pat Moran on Wednesday. On Thursday's program, a look at conflict resolution and the way in which we can resolve our conflicts in healthier ways. And on Friday, I have the honor of speaking with a very fine singer named Bill Hayes. You might remember him if you ever watched Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar. He was a frequent performer on that program. He also was in the first cast of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet, part of the original broadcast and I should say original Broadway cast. And then for over four decades, has had a role on the soap opera Days of Our Lives. I am scheduled to record an interview with him later today, which we're planning to air on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Our weather forecast.